Good morning. My name is Peter Vickery. I'm the president of a small nonprofit organization called the Center for Ecological Research. The focus of that nonprofit is primarily to do research on ecologically rare and endangered species plants. And I've worked in the Northeast, Florida, as far south as Argentina. I received my PhD from the University of Maine, I think in 1993, in wildlife ecology. My particular interest and experience with Bicknell's thrush has gone back about 35 years ago when I, having an interest in birds, was particularly interested in the distribution of Bicknell's thrush, which was then called Great Cheek Thrush, in Maine. I've followed that since. I've worked in a variety of different ways looking at Bicknell's thrush. More recently, I've had the opportunity to go to the Caribbean, to the Dominican Republic, Cuba, and Jamaica, where this species winters, and I'll talk about that more later. Next slide. I want to try and give a broader picture of what I think the conservation issues for Bicknell's thrush are, and then see if I can focus that to this site and this situation. And in my experience and in my opinion, the clear and unambiguous primary immediate threat to Bicknell's thrush is loss of wintering habitat, and depending on the islands in the Caribbean, anywhere from 75 to 90% of the habitat for Bicknell's thrush is gone. And I can just, if you think about Haiti, part of the Dominica, where Bicknell's thrush used to winter, essentially the forest has been cleared. So that's really the critical conservation, immediate conservation issue. The second one is actually predation by exotic rats in the Dominican Republic. Winter mortality from exotic rats is anywhere between 30 and 50%. So if you think about that for a second, 100 Bicknell's thrushes fly down to the Dominican Republic, make it through the migration, and then during the course of the winter, anywhere from 30 to 50 of them are not going to be coming back because they get eaten by rats at night. That puts a staggering stress on the population dynamics. So that's really, for me, those two issues just stand out far and above anything else. The next, I think, long-term conservation issue really has to do with the change in climate and how that might affect this species. Next slide, please. So I want to emphasize that habitat loss in the breeding grounds is not really a present threat. What's happening in the Caribbean is a huge threat. There are about 336 acres of traditional subalpine fir habitat in the Northeast, including Canada, that's available to Bicknell's thrush. And one of the things that's really struck me about this project in this area is the degree of industrial forestry that goes on. And there's something like 90,000 acres of regenerating spruce fir habitat in Maine. And that's habitat that is available to Bicknell's thrush. It's sort of a new habitat, but if you think of regenerating forest, and many of you saw it yesterday on the site visit, that mimics the structure of the subalpine forest that you see further up. And we know from some of the field surveys that we've done for this project that Bicknell's thrush is in fact using some of those regenerating clear cuts. So it seems to me that it's, I think we can make a case that there was actually more habitat available in 2010 than there was in 1910, 100 years ago, because of the forestry practices. Next slide.
Let's see, can I have the pointer?
Let's see if I can turn this on. Okay. What you can see here in this sort of mustardy yellow is the footprint of the proposed project right here. And what really struck me in visiting this site and looking from Kibby is really the amount of recently harvested forest, and all of this pale stuff is recently cut forest. This is all potential habitat. It wasn't in the original forest type, but it is now potential habitat for Bicknell's thrush. Next slide. And I want to show you several images that I think some of you saw yesterday. And in the foreground of all these vistas, we were thinking about wind turbines, but all of these clear cuts here provide extensive habitat, potential habitat for Bicknell's thrush. And in the distance, you can see Cow Ridge. And if I can have the next slide, this is a clear cut of greater than 100 acres at over 3,000 feet. Now, I can't tell you whether the Bicknell's thrush was there 10 years ago before the cut, but I am convinced that if this regenerates in 10 to 15 years, there will be Bicknell's thrushes up there. So the forestry practices are creating a lot of new habitat, which is a different paradigm. Next slide. On our site visit yesterday, we went up and saw the turbines. But what really struck me on my earlier visit is the amount of habitat that has been created by industrial forestry. So in this green swath, this is probably 8 to 12 years old, is something that would be available to thrushes presently. But where you can see these snowy patches, these are more recently cut, and those will probably be available to Bicknell's thrush 6 to 12 years from now. Next slide. And just a close view showing again this sort of the stunted nature of this spruce fir regeneration. Next slide. One of the things in reviewing some of the literature for all of this that really struck me is that this was a good paper on the looking at Bicknell's thrush in the White Mountains in New Hampshire. And there's been a 7% decline in a 10-year period, 7% annual decline. So that again means that 100 Bicknell's thrushes showed up in 1993. 93 showed up the following year, 86 or whatever it is. You just remove 7% of that remaining number. That's a huge decline in Bicknell's thrush. But the habitat hasn't changed appreciably in the White Mountains in those areas during that 10-year period. So I think we need to look for another explanation. To me, that means that the breeding habitat is available and isn't occupied. I think the issue, again, is on the wintering grounds. So breeding habitat is not presently a limiting factor. Next slide. But what happens with climate change? We all expect that there will be an increase in temperatures. And that's going to is likely to affect the subalpine spruce fir habitat. Next slide. And thinking about that, if the paradigm is simply that Bicknell's thrush occurs uniquely in this subalpine habitat, then the story isn't very good for Bicknell's thrush. At least that's one way you could view it. That habitat diminishes. Why wouldn't the birds diminish? Well, I think that the explanation is a lot more sophisticated and complicated than that. Next slide. So if you think of climate change, we're looking into the future, 50 years, 100 years, 200 years from now. So what's going to happen on these mountain ridges 200 years from now? That led me to think about, so what happened in the past? What happened in the last ice age? Next slide. Here you can see the breeding range of Bicknell's thrush, the present breeding range. This is, of course, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, New York, down to the Catskills. In recognition of our Canadian friends, they do, in fact, breed in Canada. But what happened during the last ice age? If you see this dark line down here, ice completely covered the entire present breeding range of Bicknell's thrush. So what happened? And that was about 16,000 years ago. Next slide. So the entire breeding range for Bicknell's thrush is under ice. So did those birds get buried in the ice for X period of time, or did they move and shift? And clearly they moved and shifted. They must have bred to the south, possibly to the west. And what that means is that they're very adaptive. They're migratory birds, and they can move around. So Bicknell's thrush, whoop, you're going faster than I am. Bicknell's thrush evolved something like 500 to 750,000 years ago. That's a period of time that we have difficulty grabbing. But during that period, there have been numerous catastrophic climate changes during this period within the range of Bicknell's thrush, and each and every time the bird has been able to adjust. It's migratory, it adapts, it's adaptive, it's moved into regenerating clear cuts, and so I have no doubt at all that this bird is going to respond to climate change by shifting its range. It may no longer be in southern New York in the Catskill Mountains, but it will be moving north or northeast or northwest or making some adjustment to its breeding range. So I think it's important to appreciate that this species has undergone numerous stressors during its 500-plus-thousand-year history, and it will. And climate change is probably going to be another one. But I don't think that that means that the species is, in fact, doomed. Next slide. I want to bring that larger discussion back to the project at hand. And as pointed out, the surveys were able to delineate core thrush habitat. I think the surveys were excellent. If you've ever tried to work in this habitat, it's remarkably challenging. It's just a tangle. So the point counts really helped identify core thrush habitat. The red line shows the more general habitat, and then the green area is subalpine fir, which can also be occupied by Bicknell's thrush. And for me, the important feature was that the core area was not divided in any way, and this general red area, where we would expect the primary activity for Bicknell's thrush, remains largely intact. I think the engineers or whomsoever did a good job of reciting the road so that it has minimal impact, and it really only touches core habitat up in the northernmost sector. Next slide. So to conclude, only 8 acres of what we really consider primary habitat or core habitat will be lost. I won't go into the breeding biology for Bicknell's thrush because it's very complicated. It's interesting. But the home range of a female is roughly 8 to 14 acres. Females can have multiple partners, multiple males that attend the nest. Males go to different females. It's a college scene. But the loss of 8 acres is essentially equivalent to about one female territory. In my mind, that's trivial. I mean, it's really inconsequential in terms of impact to the population of Bicknell's thrush in this area. With regenerating clear cuts, there's probably more breeding habitat available now than there was 100 years ago. So the impacts will be really of no consequence to Bicknell's thrush in this region. And for me, given my preoccupation, or at least certainly my thought, that the issues on the wintering ground are really the factor that's limiting Bicknell's thrush, the contribution by TransCanada to the conservation protection of thrush habitat in the Caribbean is really the most important benefit for this species in the entire equation. Thank you.
Ken, would you be able to supply some of the references that you've used in your presentation?
Yeah, I think
Lambert 2005, Lambert 2008.
Sure.
McFarland 2008 and Getz, if yep. I'm saying that right.
Yes. I had assumed that those would be part of whatever we filed, but if not, we can certainly get them to you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we are being very conscientious on our time and our clock, and my calculation, we have until 9:47, and for this last remaining panel, if we could have an additional 4 minutes to make up for the colloquy on the objections, that I think that would put us right on track.
Juliet, I think you and I are more or less in agreement. My clock says that you have until 9:53.
Thank you.
And we'll give you a 15-minute warning at 9:33.
Perfect. Thank you.
Members of the Commission, good morning. My name is John Titus. I currently work for TRC Engineers in Augusta as an environmental specialist, and I am here today in my capacity as a consultant with TRC. Previous to that, I worked for the Bureau of Parks and Lands and retired in the fall of 2008 after 30 years of state service. From 1996 to 2008, I was a senior planner for the Bureau, having direct responsibility for the development of management plans for the Bureau's public lands. I was also responsible for developing the initial draft of the Flagstaff Management Plan adopted in 2007, which included the Chain of Ponds unit. I also administered the Bureau's leasing program, which included the campground lease at Chain of Ponds. In the brief time that I have this morning, I would like to respond to a few statements made by Ms. Johnson in her pre-file testimony with regards to the public lands at Chain of Ponds. In my comments, I will be drawing from the collective experience of the staff resource managers involved in the Flagstaff area plan at that time. Ms. Johnson stated in her testimony that recreation in the area is primarily primitive in character, dependent on the natural scenic character of the surroundings. Our research back in 2005 clearly indicated that the vast majority of the uses at Chain of Ponds involve motorized recreation or some form of motorized recreation. As part of the plan process, the Bureau later committed to managing for those uses. It was also concluded that the Bigelow Preserve and Mount Abraham units also within the region provided far better opportunities for primitive recreational pursuits such as backcountry hiking and camping than did the Chain of Ponds unit. Ms. Johnson also characterized the Chain of Ponds unit as being remote feeling and a place where people go for a sense of solitude and to get away from the human-built environment. While the Chain of Ponds area is most certainly scenic, it is not considered remote. The human-built environment is very evident throughout Chain of Ponds, including the presence of State Highway Route 27, which runs along the entire length of the ponds and provides several drive-to access points along the ponds as well. Of course, there is the developed campground facilities at Natanas Point. And then there is the presence of managed regional snowmobile and ATV trail systems for which the campground also plays a significant role. This is not a place, as staff resource managers concluded at that time, where one would go to get away from it all. As I mentioned earlier, places like the Bigelow Preserve and Mount Abraham provided far better opportunities for those seeking solitude within this region of the state. Ms. Johnson also stated that this section of the Arnold Trail is particularly noteworthy for its nearly pristine and unspoiled condition and that the wilderness experience that the soldiers faced in this region. The Arnold Trail was a resource that during the planning process was recognized for its historic military significance, which we concluded at that time was most often experienced from those traveling on Route 27 and from the developed campground. Recommendations to better interpret the trail at these locations were included in the management plan. The plan also called for placing under special protection the area of the expedition route along a one-mile portion of the trail north of the campground and also along Horseshoe Stream in recognition of the more remote attributes within this section of the trail that were not found on other areas of the unit. And this is true the further you move away from the campground. I would further add that a pristine or unspoiled condition is lacking at Natanas Point and other areas on the ponds, as these places are either within sight of existing development or are subject to the road noise coming from State Highway 27. having spent considerable time on the unit myself, the road noise on and along the ponds is quite evident most of the time. In general, most users of the resource would not be impacted at all by the expansion because there would be no project visibility along Horseshoe Stream or from the Tanis Point, and very little project visibility along Route 27. And for the few who do travel the ponds, there would be some project visibility along portions of the lower ponds, but in areas where they are where there are already road impacts from Route 27. And lastly, Ms. Johnson states that the management priorities for the Chain of Ponds unit includes ensuring the scenic and primitive nature of the surroundings. This language appears in the management plan on page 100 under the Recreation Management Issues section and on page 169 under the plan recommendations for the unit. In both cases, this statement was in direct reference to the improvements at Natanas Point Campground. The original concern here was for the campground's appearance as seen from Route 27 and from the Tanis Pond, which had been an ongoing issue because of the past use of brightly colored tarps and other accessory structures along the waterfront area that had detracted from the natural surroundings. This language was also used in reference to the overall operation of the campground out of concern that it also be in keeping with the natural surroundings.
Good morning. I'm Jean Vissering, and I prepared the visual assessment for the Kippy Expansion Wind Project. Here you see the resources of state or national significance, which we identified within the 8-mile radius study area. There were four with no visibility. I'm going to briefly discuss Kippy Stream, Arnold Pond, Crosby Pond, and the Arnold Trail, which I believe would be very minimally impacted by the project. I will discuss Chain of Ponds in greater detail because of its proximity and high scenic quality. However, I do not believe that the proposed project would result in any unreasonable aesthetic impacts to any of these resources. Kippy Stream was raised by both Mr. Palmer and by Mr. Stearns. These are typical photographs of Kippy Stream, and you may recall passing by there yesterday. There is certainly considerable clear cutting that goes on around Kippy Stream, but if you look at aerial photos, it is obvious that there is a buffer, a vegetative buffer, along nearly the entire stream as is required by state law. So I would not expect there to be any significant views from the stream, with the exception of two areas that showed up on our viewshed map. I think the fact that there were those large areas of visibility on Mr. Palmer's map suggests that viewshed mapping is kind of an initial tool that needs to be further understood with more investigation. So, but these areas you saw yesterday as well, and they're more permanent open areas that are around the stream but have been long used by the landowner for equipment storage, log landings, some gravel extraction. So they're not areas where you would expect to experience high visual quality. The other area that we identified is in the very bottom here along a series of wetlands that are 7 to 8 miles from the project. And you can see in the foreground, if you, one was looking upstream from this area, there would be Kibbe Range, Kibbe Mountain, and the very northern turbines would be sort of peeking out behind Kibbe Range. Now, I will say that these areas are probably the only areas where there would be visibility from the three different mountains, Kibbe Expansion, Kibbe Mountain, and Kibbe Range. But nevertheless, I don't think that any impacts would be significant. Arnold Pond and Crosby Pond are both identified as in the National Wildlife Lands Lakes and Ponds Assessment as having outstanding scenic quality. Both of them are between 6.5 and 8 miles away from the project. And you can see that in both cases, Mount Pisgah, which includes is over here as well, would stands in the foreground, and it's a very prominent feature throughout this area. The turbines are along this area, and it's what we're looking at here is the northern turbines, and there's up to 10 of them visible. They, because they appear both at a distance, but more importantly, because Mount Pisgah appears so much higher than the turbines appear, this really diminishes any visual impacts or prominence of the turbines. The Arnold Trail is listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and along most of its length there would be no visibility, with the exception of the two areas here along Long Pond and a little bit up on Arnold Trail, Arnold Pond. And to the extent that scenic views may be important to the experience of history enthusiasts, I'd like to turn now to discussing Chain of Ponds in more detail. First, the project would be visible from less than a third of Chain of Ponds. It would not be visible from the Natanas Pond Overlook or the Natanas Point Campground, which we visited yesterday, and are probably the two areas from which most people will experience the views of the pond. It would also not be visible from the state land or from any of the campsites, the more primitive campsites around the pond. Okay, next. Now, if we take a little tour from the campground down the ponds, the project would not be visible at all, from Natanas Pond, except for a very small part down at the lower southeast end where you would see four turbines. There's two tops and two blades peeking over the ridge. This is the flanks of Pisgah. As you move into the narrows between the two ponds, between heading to Long Pond, the project completely disappears from view. It would also not be visible along the northern shore, but the southern shore of the western end of Long Pond, that you can see here on the behind the flanks of Mount Pisgah again, the turbines start to emerge, and continuing on, they gradually emerge further. Here there are four turbines. The lighting in here is not great for seeing these turbines continue. And then we get the highest visibility down at a small area of the southeast end of Long Pond, where nearly the entire project is visible, 14 turbines. and continuing on into Bag Pond, there is kind of a long stretch of sort of river-like section where there would be no visibility. There's almost no visibility at all on Bag Pond except for the extreme southwest little bay where you would get this visibility of 10 turbines. These are the northern turbines because right as you move south, the southern turbines are beginning to sort of hide behind Sisk Mountain in this case. And I wanted to make a couple of comments here on this slide. first of all, if you look at where our viewpoints were taken from, we have illustrated in our simulations the highest potential visibility from anywhere within these ponds. We've also illustrated photographs that are in good weather conditions. The turbines are shown as not blurred, but clear. Also, I think importantly, I have been seeing recently in applications panorama views submitted in which tend to diminish the apparent size of the turbines. We have only submitted views which illustrate what is called a normal view or a 50-millimeter view. So we are really showing what Mr. Palmer would refer to as the worst-case scenario. Okay, continue. This moving into Lower Pond, there would be no views of the expansion project in Lower Pond. However, we did, in looking at cumulative impacts, we did provide a simulation showing the Kibby turbines from the very lower end of Lower Pond, which is where they would be primarily visible. Here in this simulation, you can see 9 turbines, which include some of it are just tips of blades. But if you were moving west, though, that visibility would diminish significantly and with very minimal visibility in the other ponds. Okay? So up to now, I've been discussing visibility, but of course, the state law notes that visibility is not the major criteria in which you're judging whether or not there are unreasonable impacts, even from resources of state or national significance. Rather, what is important is the context in which views are seen and viewer experience. So if we could continue, I'd like to just begin by talking a little bit about that context. The Wildlands Lake Assessment identifies as the contributing elements to chain of ponds the immediate shoreline and the dramatic relief. And if you look at this map, you can see surrounding the pond are Mount Pisgah, Sisk Mountain, Bag Pond Mountain, and Indian Stream Mountain. And you see that topography dropping off dramatically into the ponds, creating the fjord-like setting that is mentioned in the Flagstaff Management Plan. You can also see that the project itself is set well back from these foreground features. More importantly, from a human eye point of view, these mountains dominate the views around the pond. The foreground peaks appear higher, closer to the viewer, and in many cases, they block all or part of the project from view. Okay. By contrast, the project ridge is not a distinct or dramatic feature in any views. Now, as looking at viewer expectations, John Titus spoke a moment ago about the fact that Chain of Ponds is regarded more as a developed and non-remote landscape unit. Route 27 is very visible and always audible. The commercial campground, along with the RVs, private camps, the motorboats, are certainly part of this setting, and they will certainly influence the viewer expectations. This setting is indeed highly scenic, but it is not remote, pristine, or a wilderness. Okay, I want to return here to viewpoint 5, which is discussed by Mr. Palmer, Ms. Johnson, and other interveners as being a very an indication of a very prominent view. Now, of course, this simulation focuses at this particular scene. By necessity, and it is a normal view. But remember that what we would be experiencing in the larger center, in the larger sense, is the context, the surrounding context, which will include peaks, which in this case, Pisgah and Sisk, which are significantly higher, closer, and more prominent than the foreground ridge. Now, also, this is not an area which is a static. We do not experience these views as static elements. That area that we were looking at is not a place where people necessarily stay. There are no camps right there. The experience on the pond generally is paddling along or motorboating along or moving along the pond. So it is a sequence of changing views, and some of the views that we would see, the dominant views we would see around the pond would include Pisgah, Sisk, Indian Stream Mountain, Bag Pond Mountain, which is the flanks that are on the right, glimpses of the Bigelows, which you remember from yesterday, some of the dramatic cliffs that are specifically mentioned in the lake assessment, as well as the bouldery shorelines, also specifically mentioned. So, although this is one point from which we might experience the project, There are also many other points. You change the slide. There are also many other points, in fact, two-thirds of the pond from which the project would not be visible, and even more of the pond from which only a few turbines would be seen. Okay. So there has been some suggestion of removing potentially the seven southern turbines, which I think would have very minimal overall benefits. Because, first of all, if you recall, the only place where the southern seven are seen by themselves is that a little bit of the northern shoreline of the western end of Long Pond, where they are gradually coming into view. If you could switch. They are visible really only in a relatively small part of just Long Pond. They are not visible in most of the rest of the lake. Remember, at Bag Pond, we're only looking at the northern turbines. We're only looking at the northern turbines from Crosby and from Arnold. So I do not think that the project as proposed would be unreasonable, especially given the way in which these turbines are viewed. Okay, last slide. Now I'd like to look very briefly at the issue of cumulative impacts. There's a number of ways that can be addressed, and I've listed a few of them. Numbers of turbines in the view. They're looking at perhaps the maximum number of turbines one might see would be from two very small portions of chain of ponds where you would see that very small back bay of Bag Pond, or that little tiny area of Long Pond where you might see the up to 16 turbines, which would include tips of blades. That would be the maximum number in two tiny areas. So I think that overall we're talking about a relatively small number, and of course, more importantly, is the opportunity to see unaffected views. The prominent foreground features, those features which are focal points in the landscape, are unaffected, and they are the features which really dominate views around the pond. Moreover, if you look at those simulations and you think of them in the larger context, the turbines will occupy a very small part of any views, and that very narrow angle of view. There is nowhere, they are also all oriented, and because the projects are adjacent to each other, in a similar direction. There is nowhere where someone is going to be anywhere close to being surrounded by turbines. There will be open and unaffected views all around the viewer. And finally, just looking at the sequence of views throughout the region, most people, of course, are going to be experiencing this area by Route 27 or the campgrounds, possibly viewing some of the really spectacular and remote scenery in the Flagstaff area. But even on these lakes, the views of the turbines are going to be subtle, coming in and out of view, and generally viewed from relatively few areas. So I don't believe that there would be unreasonable impacts on the scenic character of the area, and I think that one will be very much able to continue to enjoy the resources that have been identified.
Hello, is this on? My name is Jeff Seltzer. I'm an attorney at Verrill Dana in Portland, Maine, where I practice land use, natural resources, and forest land law. My other qualifications are as stated in my pre-filed report. I'm going to talk very quickly because I understand I'm running out of time. Okay. In my pre-file testimony, I analyzed the project's consistency with LURC's comprehensive land use plan and concluded that not only is the project consistent with the CLUP, but from a policy standpoint, the project is ideally situated. The consolidated parties have contended that this is not the case and have suggested that there are numerous areas across the state that could accommodate a wind power project with fewer impacts to public values. My comments today are in response to that suggestion, which I do not believe is accurate. Maine, as we know, is blessed with an abundance of natural resources, many of which define the distinctive character of LURC's jurisdiction and much of the rest of the state. everything we do in our landscape, every use of the land will impact those resources, whether we're cutting a new hiking trail, building a nature observation blind, establishing a backwoods campsite or a developed campground, building a home, a chip mill, or a wind farm. Everything we do on the land has some level of impact to those natural resources. The objective of the Comprehensive Land Use Plan and all contemporary land use planning policy is to guide these uses and their related impacts to the areas most able to accommodate them. This frequently involves balancing multiple, sometimes competing goals in a manner that ensures the separation of incompatible uses and the protection of important public values. In furtherance of this objective, the club's energy resources goal is to provide for the environmentally sound and socially beneficial utilization of indigenous energy resources when there are no overriding public values that require protection. And the club discusses at length the commission's commitment to addressing climate change and energy issues. As noted earlier, Maine is blessed with significant natural resources, one of which is its substantial wind resource. Next slide, please. This map shows the distribution of that resource across the state. The problem, of course, is that in many instances, these locations also coincide with other natural resources with important public values. Of particular note are Baxter State Park area and Acadia National Park, where the balance is skewed very much against development of any appreciable nature and very much in favor of a high level of protection of those resources. If we remove from this map those areas outside of the expedited permitting area, not because it is forbidden to develop wind there, but because on a macro level it is an indication of where the balance between development and protection of natural resources is more difficult and complicated, then we are left with substantially fewer locations that have a high wind resource that might be appropriate for wind development. Contrary to the inference of the consolidated interveners, most of these locations are in areas with high-value natural resources or other public values and considerations that would require a careful analysis of the impacts of these resources in connection with any wind power development application in those areas. I'm going to briefly just highlight some of the considerations that would come into play with wind development in some of these other areas. For example, there are numerous recreational wildlife and scenic assets that are still in the expedited area, most notably the Appalachian Trail, which runs generally along this corridor here and comes in and out of the expedited area, the Mahoosuc Unit and the Grafton Loop Trail, the Kennebec Highlands Public Reserve Unit, which is in this area here, the Mount Blue and Tumbledown areas, which is this wind resource here, the Donnell Pond and Tunk Lake units here in the Down East area, the Cutler Pond Cutler Lake Public Lands, which is over here, the Sunshine Conservation Easement and Fee Conservation Areas, which are mostly covered by this large swath of the non-expedited area but do peak out around the area with their significant lake resources, Sugarloaf, Crocker Mountain, and the other 4,000 footers in the region of the Bigelows, which also have large subalpine habitats, the Bald Mountain and Rangeley Lake region here, Boundary Bald Mountain, which is tucked up in this area up here, as well as the Little Big Public Reserve Unit and Misery Ridge and the associated Plum Creek Conservation Area, which has a limited allowance for wind development. You also have important bog areas, such as the 1,000-acre bog here and the Great Heath down here in Hancock County. You have Mount Chase and Long Mountain, which are these windy areas here, which are visible from the northern peaks of Baxter State Park. The important number 9 mountain cluster in Aroostook County, one of only two significant mountain hiking locations in the county, the other being the Squapan Mountain ridgeline, which is right up here. And you also have the Eagle Lake Public Reserve lands up here in the north. Other considerations that come into play when citing wind power development are the remote locations, such as the organized town of Allegash, which although is not in LIRC's jurisdiction, shares many of the attributes of LIRC's remote core. It is also along the Allegash Wilderness Waterway. And finally, other considerations are distance from transmission infrastructure. Mostly the northern part of the state here is very distant from transmission infrastructure, and any wind power development in that area would necessarily entail considerable transmission corridor development as well. You also have some heavily populated areas here. There's 20 or 30,000 people that populate these areas in and around Presque Isle, Limestone, Caribou, and there are some considerations, public policy considerations, citing wind power in these areas. The Commission has done an excellent job of accommodating wind development where it does make sense. Examples are Stetson and the initial Kibbe project, which is right here, and not allowing wind development in areas with higher natural resource and other public values, such as the Black Knuble project, which was proposed in an area in the immediate and prominent viewshed of more than half of Maine's 4,000-foot peaks. Like the initial Kibby Wind project, the Kibby expansion project is relatively free from impacts to high public values and is in a location very well suited for wind development. It is uniquely situated far from residential development but close to service centers. It is not in a remote location of the jurisdiction. It is in the fastest or second fastest, depending on how you measure it, growing section of the unorganized territories. It is in very close proximity to existing transmission infrastructure, obviously because of the original Kibby project. It allows for concentration of these uses into a single location. It is not in an area used for remote or primitive recreation, and in fact, areas used for remote and primitive recreation are readily available nearby, and most people will pass them on the way to this area. As you all saw on your trip yesterday, you drove by the Bigelow unit on your way to this area. The recreational and scenic assets of the location are already compatible with and impacted by existing developments, such as Route 27 and the developed campground, and they depend on the immediate foreground scenic features rather than on distant views. It is also not in an area with high or pressing conservation priorities, and as was demonstrated in the testimony of the other parties and in the application materials, there is no unreasonable impact on natural communities, other environmental or scenic resources. Simply put, the Kibby expansion project area does not possess overriding public values requiring protection that would outweigh the benefits of the project or which would otherwise cause the project to be inconsistent with a comprehensive land use plan or lurks other regulations and policies. And contrary to the suggestion of the consolidated parties, there do not appear to be many other areas in the state that have fewer public value considerations for accommodating wind power development. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to take a 10-minute recess and be back here.
10:07.
At 10:07.
That gives 7 minutes.